Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. A lot to talk about today. The headlines from over the weekend, there's a lot going on. We'll discuss that. Also, Donald Trump's New World Order, as some are calling it, is taking shape, and we'll look into what that might look like. Also, we'll take a look at the college culture here in the U.S. today. The recent election reveals a lot about that. We'll have some details and more coming up on this Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We are online, kpcg.fm, and a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. I'm Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau with me here today. Grant Turgeon, usually with us, is got a cold or a flu or something, so
right.
he's out. But he'll be back, I'm pretty sure, at some point.
Yes, yeah, down but not out completely.
Not yet. Sneaks up on you. No, hopefully he'll be back in a day or so. So, but a lot to talk about on today's program, some headlines from over the weekend. And one of the big ones here from the United States is more police violence. Reuters has a little bit of a write-up about that. Police officers shot in Texas, Missouri, and Florida. A police officer was killed in Texas and another wounded in Missouri in apparently unrelated ambush-style shootings. And then a third officer was shot and wounded in Florida, authorities said Monday. And so the thing that's unique about this is that they appear to be ambush attacks. Police officers obviously get killed in the line of duty sometimes. It's a very dangerous job. But these appear to be ambush attacks. From what I read about the one in Texas, he was, I think, writing a ticket, and somebody came up and shot him. And I think that person's still on the run at this point. So... from what they could tell, it didn't seem to be related, like the traffic ticket and the killing. So we've seen quite a few of these, and now it seems like it's continuing.
Yeah, this is a new age of police violence, because there always have been officers injured in the line of duty or who have died. But it hasn't really been in necessarily police or violence targeting the police specifically in things like this, where people make the conscious choice to lay an ambush for a police officer, and the whole purpose of the crime is to kill or injure the police officer. It has nothing to do with another crime where they get caught in the line of fire. So this is a dangerous time, and especially they're becoming almost like everyday occurrences, and it's like the mode of operation that we expect to see from violence now.
Yeah, and it used to seem to be that because the penalties were so high for shooting an officer, that was something people would particularly avoid. Only the most desperate, most dangerous type of criminal would take a chance on that. I guess I base that off of TV shows, which isn't a great way to base that. But, you know, I mean, years ago you'd watch something and you'd see a show and there'd be some sort of a crime and they'd say, oh, you know that was a police officer, right? And they'd say, oh, no, because that was a huge penalty. And obviously there should be a huge penalty for that. But now people are getting more brazen. And, of course, we remember what happened in Dallas. That was, I guess, last year or this year. Yeah,
yes.
This past year.
Yeah.
And just people becoming more brazen in that type of thing. So I think that's really the difference that we're seeing, is sort of this brazen attitude to go after these officers. And in a lot of cases, they're trying to help, trying to, you know, keep the community safe. Even writing a traffic ticket, we've probably have all gotten a traffic ticket a time or two, and we never like getting those, but it is good because it does make you slow down, does make you pay attention. Even this weekend, I was driving in Oklahoma City area, and I came up, coming up to a light, and I was, I don't know, 5 seconds away from arriving at the light, and it turned yellow, so I slowed down, and I stopped, and as I was stopping, it had already been red for a second or two, and I look at, and it's a two-lane going one direction. And I look in my rearview mirror, and a guy in the lane next to me flying. And I'm thinking, no way. Sure enough, I ran right through that red light. Thankfully, the other traffic hadn't arrived yet. He would have hit everybody.
Right.
And I just couldn't believe it. And that's where I was like, I wish there was a officer here right now. That guy needs to be pulled over because you're going to kill somebody with that type of behavior. So, you know, we don't personally like getting tickets when it happens, but it is good. We need that type of law enforcement because it protects everybody from foolish mistakes and just crazy driving that you see sometimes.
Yeah. It's actually, my wife and I were talking about this about a month ago. She was in the Philippines last year, and when she was... If anyone's been to the Philippines, they don't have traffic laws. People get around and they don't have a whole lot of accidents, but it's chaos.
Right.
There's people back going reverse into the middle of an interstate. People have to slam on their brakes going 70 miles an hour. People weaving in and out of, there's no blinkers. There's really nothing going on there in semblance of order. And just it's nerve-wracking, especially if you're not used to it, if you're a Westerner visiting. And she was sitting there looking at that, and then we were driving through Oklahoma City as well, and just seeing how most people are orderly. They stay in their lane. You can pass within 3 feet of another car going 70 miles an hour, and you're not afraid that it's going to hit you. And that just that sort of order allows us to function and to have a pretty peaceful life. And that's the role of police officers, because if that falls apart, how difficult would our lives become? And then think about the more dangerous side of their jobs. That's just traffic laws.
Yeah.
People who have spouses that abuse them, they get into dangerous situations with criminals or that sort of thing. The police are there to help save people from those situations, to make sure that society doesn't descend into anarchy. And that what's most dangerous about this, like you mentioned, is that we have this attitude prevailing where common citizens, not necessarily people who have been lifelong criminals, deciding that it's a good idea to go murder a police officer. And that's just a really dangerous turn of events where average people are turning more and more to that kind of behavior.
Yep, so a dangerous and violent weekend there. And at this time, they still have not found that person that's that killed the officer, I believe. But, of course, those details always change quite rapidly. Another headline from this weekend was, of course, we reported on this here at KPCG. It was a train derailment there in northern India. At least 115 people were killed when an overnight passenger train rolled off the track in northern India early on Sunday, with rescuers working into the night to pull people out of the mangled coaches, police said. The death toll was expected to rise further because rescue workers had yet to gain access to one of the worst damaged of the 14 coaches that derailed. So they think that number will go up. That does happen from time to time. Lots of people on those trains, and sometimes there's accidents, and they're pretty severe. We had a couple of train accidents here in the U.S. last week, not derailments, but hitting vehicles. They were on the nightly news. Train hit a tractor trailer. I don't know exactly what happened, if the guy didn't see the train or what, but it just plowed right through the middle of that thing. And then a car got hit. And in that case, they had just been involved. The car had just been involved in some sort of a hit and run. They were trying to flee the scene, and then they got hit by a train. So they walked away, and some injuries. They damaged the train as well. Sometimes justice is immediate, isn't it?
Yeah, instant justice. Right. Yeah.
Not that you ever want to see that, but, you know, I felt bad for them, and then I heard they were running from a hit and run, and I thought, well... Okay. I mean, you kind of chose your path there.
Yeah.
Thankfully, they're okay, but I'm sure they're going to have quite a big fine or whatever the penalty is for something like that.
Yeah. Train derailments, they're pretty catastrophic because they're heavy, and the people inside don't have a whole lot of safety mechanisms to keep them safe when something like that happens. There was one in Quebec a few years ago where a train carrying... sensitive I think it was gasoline and other chemicals, it crashed, and there was just huge explosions around the city there. So there's always that risk, and even though we don't really think about it, train travel is really still common, but especially the transport of materials, and when those things happen, it can be pretty catastrophic.
When I'm on the highway, if I see a semi truck and it's got that sign on the back indicating flammable materials, I try to get away from that vehicle as soon as possible. I always have that fear that something's going to happen. So I stay away from those as much as I can. Or sometimes you come up behind like a really old truck that has an open bed in the back and they've got big propane tanks in there.
Yeah.
I always stay away from those too. Or the random person that's transporting all of their earthly possessions on the back of a vehicle at the top of their car, and it's held on by a few bungee cords. There's a rocking chair. I just envision that all coming off the vehicle and hitting me, so I try to get away from those people, too.
Yeah. I know whenever you drive on the highway, you always see abandoned furniture on the side of the road, and I think my family would always call them roadside charities. Because if you want it, you can just go pick it up. But, yeah, it is terrifying. We see people stack their whole house on the back of their truck and then and go for it. I mean, sometimes it works, but most of the time it doesn't.
Sometimes you literally see a house.
Yeah.
Where they'll have a house, and it's like half of the house, a modular home, and they're driving it down the highway. And it's always strange. You just get out of the way of the house.
Yeah, actually, when I was younger, a teenager, we were coming back from we went waterboarding.
You went what now?
Sorry, not water. Excuse me. We didn't go waterboarding.
You guys do some strange things for fun up there in Canada.
We went wakeboarding.
Wakeboarding.
Excuse me.
It is on the water. Does involve a board.
To some of us, it was waterboarding because we got dragged in the lake. So we went wakeboarding, and we were driving down in a big white van down the road, and all of a sudden, all the cars start scurrying off the road into these little side on different driveways or side dirt roads. We're like, what's going on? Then we see coming down the road this huge semi-truck carrying a house, and it covers both lanes.
Oh, wow.
And it's just coming, and so we have to try to get out of the way.
yeah. What do? You just move, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happens. Sometimes you see that something similar happen where you pull up to an intersection, you're the first one in line, and a big semi's got to make that turn.
Yeah.
And you realize he's not going to make it. So you hope no one's behind you. Or hopefully everyone's paying attention so everyone backs up because those trucks don't stop. And I think I have seen it once where it rolled over the top of somebody's, the hood at least.
Yeah.
And what do you do? You're just like, you know, you got to move, got to get out of the way.
Yeah, that's the only time I usually get nervous driving is when there's a semi-truck because even on the highway when you're passing them or especially when you have to go in between them. it's always the worst because if they don't see you and they change lanes, I mean, you don't really have much of a chance.
You have to get out of the blind spot.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get stuck in that blind spot. They can't see you. So we need all the goods they transport, but yeah, those are big vehicles. If you're traveling for the Thanksgiving holiday and you're going through the Chicago O'Hare Airport, you might want to pay attention today. O'Hare Airport workers to announce strike date today, sometime. So Thanksgiving holiday air travelers will soon learn when hundreds of workers plan to strike this week at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. The workers are seeking union rights and $15 an hour. Give us more money or we're going to strike. They don't think that it will be enough employees to cause a major delay. I'm not exactly sure. You know, there's a lot of jobs at an airport. It's not like it's all pilots and people moving your bags around. A lot of them are kind of behind the scenes. And I think it might be some more of those sort of behind-the-scenes people. But anyway, what's interesting, they're striking or threatening to strike. They want $15 per hour, but they also say they don't think there'll be any delay in the operation of the airport. So why are they there in the first place?
Yeah.
Striking can work unless you're just alerting your employer that you don't need to be there anyway. So it's a dangerous game.
Yeah, striking has always struck me as an odd thing to do because you don't get paid. You just stand out in the street with a sign, usually in the winter time, and it makes all your customers angry because they're not getting the services. Especially at the airport there, It's always interesting when that happens, and when it comes to vital services the country needs, because it can cause big emergencies. I think in World War II there were a bunch of strikes that happened before the war started, but when the war started, FDR asked the people to put their differences aside for the good of the country, and they did so. Maybe they do need. I don't know what kind of jobs they have that for the $15 an hour increase, but. I guess they think they need it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm not sure on all the legalities there, but you sometimes people just lose their jobs and they just bring in somebody else.
Yeah.
They tried to do that with the NFL years ago. I think it was in the 80s where the teams were striking. And so they just brought in replacement players.
Right.
It was terrible. And they did it with the referees a couple years ago, the famous, the infamous replacement refs. And they blew enough calls to where they had to bring the other guys back. I don't know. The regular guys blow plenty of calls too, so I'm not sure. Yeah. But I guess they're better.
There was early 2000s, the NHL was locked out because they couldn't reach a contract with the NHLPA, which is like the Players Association, their union. So I remember I was just angry because there wasn't hockey for a whole year. And
what are you going to do in Canada? Hockey for a year. Got to go to curling, professional curling.
Yeah, you
curling.
Only can take so many maple syrup shots, I mean, until you have to do something else with your life. So it was a little frustrating, especially how much money they get paid. I mean, when you get paid that much money, you do need to protect yourself, but it is ridiculous sometimes these strikes, the things that they want or demand and the wages they want to see increased.
Yeah, I don't know that strikes have ever really produced great results, but they still keep trying them. So if you're going through Chicago, that might affect your travel plans, especially if they could get other people to join in with them. I think that's their hope, is to get a lot of people to join in to make the strike impactful. So we'll see what happens there. Thanksgiving, not for them, I guess. They're not very thankful. They want to strike. Gallup.com, interesting. I've never looked at their website before, but it's an interesting website. They have a headline here, record high, 77% of Americans perceive nation as divided. That's a record. So people, we were supposed to come together, but people don't think we have.
Right. Yeah, it's, I'm actually surprised that people would admit that as much, I guess, but it is a good sign that people see it. It's a good sign of a bad sign.
Yeah.
Because it's good that people recognize the state of the country, but I think it's just really obvious that it is really divided on partisan lines, racial lines, any different way you look at it. There's just a lot of division. And especially with the media and the left not really conceding defeat to Donald Trump, or just not being willing to really give him a chance. I think that causes a lot of more division and just going to keep making the antagonisms worse that already existed before the election even happened.
Yeah, well, we were doing the election coverage live here on the radio on KPCG, and you know, it's amazing. It was pretty much split, most of the states except for the extremely liberal ones. It was very much split down the line, 50-50, and then even here with this Gallup poll, 45% think that President-elect Trump will unify the nation more, 49% think he will divide it more. So even that's almost split down the middle. And the remaining percentage, I guess, were confused or didn't care. So, but that's that we saw that in the election. We see that even in these polls. It's kind of split down the middle what people think, what is good and what is bad. So when you have that, well, how are you gonna come together? Well, it's a 50-50 split down the middle. So, but most people at least can agree that America is divided. And yeah, we'd like to see it become more unified in the right direction, but that doesn't seem to be going that way.
Yeah, it's with all the words that have been thrown around here, I think it's pretty much impossible for any unity to happen. I mean, when you have the president say certain things to undermine the president-elect, when you have even his, Donald Trump, undermining the left's credibility, it comes from both sides. But when you have them undermining each other, attacking each other, and then all of a sudden, as soon as the election's over, they say, oh, we need to come together. Like, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
And especially with even before that, the past 8 years of how the nation has become divided then, and it's just becoming more and more intensified. It's a very long-term process, and it's been a long-term process of division. And it would take a long time to heal the nation unless there's some kind of tragic disaster like the Civil War that forced people to choose a side and come together once it was all over to try to make the best out of it. But until people are pushed to extremes, they'd rather, most people like to stick to their sides until they're forced to do some more of a extreme measure.
Well, there's no baseline of belief, and I think that's what the biggest issue. Nobody can agree on right and wrong. That's so up in the air. And that's probably split down the middle. You know, you can look at all kinds of topics, right? You could look at abortion. You could look at homosexuality. You could look at, boy, you name it. And people are, they disagree about if there's a right or a wrong. And so it's impossible to come together unless you can agree that there is some sort of basis for what we believe instead of this ambiguous, democracy and be nice to people, which doesn't mean a whole lot when there's no baseline for beliefs.
Yeah, that's why moral relativism doesn't work, is because, people can have their own opinions, but if you're allowed to believe whatever you want and you have equal rights to protect any type of belief, any conflict of interest, those conflicts of interest still exist. And they're not solved by tolerance or other things. And so in America, we really see that where you have different lifestyles clashing. It's not in ideologies, but abortion, gay marriage, Christians, all these different subjects. It's a clash of lifestyles, and people aren't going to change those. So until one prevails or the other, until a law comes that sweeps across the board, all these different things, you're always going to have that conflict of interest. And we're just really seeing it intensify today because these are a lot of hot topics that touch at people's base beliefs. And so, like you said, until there's a consensus, there will be no unity.
One of the things people are divided on is immigration, illegal immigration. And this ties into that. This next headline is from MRCTV.org. 1,500 per day. Border Patrol opens temporary facility to accommodate border surge. So they keep pouring across the border, apparently. Immigration officials at the U.S.-Mexico border have been forced to open a new temporary facility in Texas to accommodate a recent surge of illegal alien border crossers, a wave of nearly 1,500 people per day that once again threatened to overwhelm Border Patrol and create a housing crisis for thousands of alien families and children. In October alone, Customs and Border Protection apprehended 46,197 illegal aliens crossing into the United States unlawfully via the southwest U.S. border, including 13,124 members of family units. Family units, that's interesting. And another 6,754 unaccompanied children. It's always so strange. Imagine being a kid and just having to run across the border into another land. It'd be very scary. It says, in fact, the number of family unit members apprehended in the first month of 2017 is already 118% higher than those who were caught in October of last year. So I don't know. I guess they see this little window before the next administration. Maybe that's why they're pouring across the border. In fact, some that have been apprehended have said just that. Well, if we get here now, then we'll be okay. So that number of people crossing the border illegally is surging.
Yeah, this is immigration was one of the big debate points in some ways during the election, or points of controversy, I should say. And we can see it's despite all the talk and the controversy, there still is no solution to it, and it's still occurring. And for the finest solution to this, it is hard to find the right balance, I think, because we do want to help the people of Mexico, especially those who are in legitimate need. There is a legal process to do that. And if it's not done properly, it can cause a lot of problems in American society. And just and so you have to find that balance. And really, the solution is to fix Mexico. That's the only way to really fix the problem is that if you fix Mexico, then you have a stable country that can help their own people. And because America, at this rate, we will be supporting both countries in a sense by having all these people coming across our border. So the only solution is to try to fix the problems there in Mexico, give them some more help so they can take care of their own people. But at the same time, you have to uphold the law of the land. And if you don't, if you compromise on that, then it opens the door for lots of undercompromise compromise and just a lot of things might fall apart.
Right. And even if everyone coming across isn't the world's greatest criminal, right, just financially, the United States cannot pay for all this. It can't house everybody. And I just wonder, you know, I wonder why they don't talk more about, and maybe they do and I just haven't heard it, but talk more about some sort of an aid package for Mexico.
Right.
Stay put. And we'll give you some aid to help you, you know, under certain conditions. But the thing is, what do you have to do there? You've got to get rid of the drug trade because it's corrupt. And there's so many problems there. And, of course, why are they making the drugs? Well, it's because people in the U.S. want to buy them. So there's problems at home to fix there, too. It's not as simple as one thing. And I think that's the issue with all of these problems. It's not one quick little fix. It's a whole layer of dominoes, if you will, all set up, and you've got to have them all go together at the same time. You know, fix the drug problem, fix their economy, all those things, and then they probably stay put.
Yeah, it's a complex situation. It's not one answer for everything. It's not really that simple. And you're right, to fix Mexico's problems, you have to fix a lot of America's problems too, because they feed off of each other. And so it would take a big revolution in American society to fix the drug culture that has just blossomed here. And then you'd also have to basically go to war against the drug cartels as well with firepower. I mean, they're not going to have a peace deal.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's a lot of drastic action. But, I mean, for these people, that's reality.
And we're actually going the other way, aren't we? Where they, at least the current administration, has said, well, look, the drug offenses aren't that big of a deal. They shouldn't have the big prison terms, let them out. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to go back to more drugs. And if there's not as big of a penalty for it, why would you stop? You know, so it's going the opposite direction, unfortunately. So it's going to continue to be a problem in this country, and then also it's a problem in Mexico and those other countries too. And there's a lot of violence when you start looking at the drug cartels. I mean, it's brutal, and I mean, everybody knows that.
Yeah, it's some of the worst images and things you can think of what they do to their fellow countrymen for greed, really. But one of the biggest problems is getting rid of the drug culture in America, and I think with the heroin epidemic that was going on there.
Interesting point about that, just that you bring it up. I read a stat the other day about opioids, which I guess heroin fits into that category.
Right.
One person dies every 19 minutes from that, from an overdose. One person every 19 minutes. So our hour-long show today, there'll be several fatalities.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the leader of the free world, supposedly, that in our society we have those kinds of problems. And, I mean, I think most people saw this. I think it was on Fox, but this would have been maybe 2 months ago with the picture of the two parents pass out in the front seat of their car.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Little kid in the back seat.
Yeah.
They're passed out from heroin, and they have like a 5-6-year-old child in the back seat. Yeah. I mean, never mind just the problems with Mexico. I mean, just in our societies where you have parents tearing apart families because of drugs, et cetera. I mean, that's just a recipe for disaster. And that's a huge problem that we have to address. And our solution is to make drugs legal. It's to make them easier to get, make the penalties less, and that's just going to compound the problem. It's not even close to finding the solution.
Yep. So it's a bad deal there on the border. Of course, it's a multifaceted issue. Abraham, do you consider yourself to be a morning person?
Depends what day of the week.
What do you mean by morning? What time of the day? Here are 8 morning habits of successful people, they think. And this is talking pretty much about just physical things. I guess you could talk about some spiritual components, but they're talking physical here. And so here's what the morning people like to do. Number one, they like to stay positive. Wake up with a positive outlook. They say that's a good way to start the day. You don't want to be negative. So I guess you got to be well rested, which is another point that comes up. But if you wake up and you're like, oh, no, probably not going to be a great day. You want to wake up positive.
Yeah, I think waking up with ambition and excitement about what you're going to do with your time, I think that usually overcomes the dread of waking up at an early hour.
Yeah, they say whether it's looking at a picture, listening to a song, or speaking an affirmation, I guess I can't say pray, so... get positive from the start of the day. So that's some good general advice. How you get positive, though, I guess that would be another topic. Number two, they say you should eat breakfast. Denying yourself breakfast is like racing a car without fuel. And have a good breakfast, too. Can't have the Cocoa Crisps or whatever those things are called. All those cereals out there.
Yeah, it's amazing. When I was single, trying to find a healthy, cheap cereal solution, and there really isn't one out there. But breakfast is really important, and it just helps you feel like you've already achieved something before the day has even started.
It's one of the big problems that they say kids have in school. They don't eat breakfast sometimes. And then, or they eat a very sugary breakfast, which give you a high and then a quick low. You crash after the effects wear off, I guess. And so they have a hard time focusing. And so breakfast can help that. A good breakfast. Number three, they say schedule success. Write that into your planner. Success today. Each day contains the same amount of minutes, they say, yet those who are successful ensure they take advantage of every second. So you should plan and schedule what you're going to be doing, which is a good idea. It's easy to waste time by... just wasting time, especially with the internet. It's easy to get up and just kind of whittle some time away, checking out the scores and highlights and news stories and so forth.
Yeah, it's amazing that just how easily we can become distracted, and just our time just disappears when we need to be preparing for something or driving someplace. And just on the weekend, I was talking to some friends and said that it's amazing how much time you can waste watching 6-second vines, like those little 6-second videos.
Right.
Or just anything else. It's amazing just how much time you can waste when there's probably a lot of other things you don't want to do, but they need to get done.
Yeah, it's very addictive to just watch things or, whittle your time away. They say you should also exercise regularly. That helps you just have a better start to your day. Sometimes people exercise in the morning, but just good exercise in general helps your scheduling, I guess, of the way you sleep and the way you get up. They say sleeping well is important, and so you need to get at least 8 hours, they think, if possible. At least give yourself a chance. Give yourself a chance. I did this last night. I pat myself on the back. I was watching the Packer game. I'm a Packer fan. It was close, but I was like, I need to go to bed now, and I knew the Packers would lose because they've been playing terribly. And I went to bed. I slept peacefully. I woke up and I checked the headlines, and I was right. They got killed. So I didn't waste my time staying up watching it happen. So that was good for me. Pat myself on the back. Number six, they say you should clear your space. They're talking about meditation. We would probably read more into prayer time there or something like that. But that's what they say you should do in the morning. Number seven, keep your eye on the prize. Successful people make winning a lifestyle. I was thinking, was that guy, Charlie Sheen?
Yeah.
He always said he was winning when he was losing.
Yeah.
I think they mean real winning in this case. They say the morning hours are reserved for, just getting your head on straight. They've got all kinds of ideas about it. But again, I think it gets back to a spiritual component there. And number eight, find some quiet. They say a successful person's day may be filled with intense meetings and travel, like so on and so forth. But if you can keep those morning hours a little bit quieter, not be distracted with a bunch of things, then that helps. I know I've got a certain amount of time in the morning before my kids start making sounds and playing music and practicing violin.
Right.
Once the violin starts, nothing else is happening.
Yeah, the fat lady is sung, so.
Can't stay focused when that violin's a-going. So those are some of the habits that the successful people do in the morning. And I'm assuming that's early in the morning. If you define your morning by, noon, that's probably not great.
Or just before noon.
Yeah. Got up at 11. Of course, this is happening. I'm a big NBA fan. Well, I shouldn't say NBA fan. I'm a basketball fan. I don't know, the NBA. Sometimes I like it. Sometimes I don't. But one of the things that bothers people about the NBA is the loosey-goosey rules. What's the rule? Are there any rules to this game?
Right.
The coach of the Golden State Warriors, Steve Kerr, he's been fined $25,000 for complaints about NBA's nightly, quote, blooper reel of missed traveling calls. So Grant will be sad he's not here to weigh in on this, being a basketball fan and not liking Golden State because of Kevin Durant. But Steve Kerr said this. He says, how is it that everybody on Earth can see, except for blind people, I guess, how is it that everybody on Earth can see these traveling violations except for the three people that we pay to do the job? He says, I don't get it. It's bizarre. Traveling, he said, it's a point of emphasis on one particular play, and that's when you catch and go, it's just the one that the officials are taught to see. In other words, they only call it very rarely. He says, but I can literally put together a blooper reel of plays that are embarrassing travels that are just not called. He says, I believe it's a case of they have so many things to look at, and they're not looking at the basic rule of the game, which is traveling. And I think he's right. you can't criticize the officials publicly. You will be fined for it. I understand why they do it that way. But Shaquille O'Neal does that Shaqtin' a Fool video.
Right.
Instead of acting a fool.
Yeah.
Where it's bloopers from NBA games. And they'll do ones on traveling. And there was one where I think a guy took 8 steps.
Right.
And they didn't call it travel. In the NBA, you're allowed, what is it now? I always forget. I think it's 2, technically.
Right.
But they take so many steps all the time. It's constantly illegal, and I think it frustrates fans. So I agree with Steve Kerr on this. It's frustrating.
Yeah, I remember seeing that particular video, and it's just amazing that most, even people who don't know basketball that well can see it, and it's obvious. And in the heat of a game, they want to be careful what they call because they don't want to change the balance of the game and that sort of thing, I think, too. But at the same time, as he says, traveling is one of those basic rules. And if you violate that, you get a big advantage that you shouldn't be able to have. And well, it's just and it just ruins the game, too.
It does. It takes it because what's beautiful about a game is when you see a really good play or a move within the rules. For hockey, for example, if you could just, I don't think you can do this. If you could just pick the puck up, put it in your pocket, skate around and throw it in the...
Right.
That would kind of take away from what you're trying to accomplish out there. And it might be easier. I don't know. But that's not the point of the game. So you see a player, take 3 steps, push 4 guys over, take another step, jump up and dunk the ball. There's nothing exciting about that. That's a poor play, poorly officiated, and they should call the travels, make the game better.
Yeah, and especially with the amount of money people pay to watch, the excitement and the money the players get to play, just the fact that they honor the rules and that they use they're all pretty skilled, like highly skilled. They use their skills within the rules. I think that makes it a lot more exciting. Fans appreciate it more, and it just makes the game more balanced and fair, where they have to play better sportsmanship, better rivalry, to get the points rather than just taking the easy way out, I guess.
Yeah, and then it trickles down because younger kids watch it. And then when they go out and play and somebody says, well, you're traveling, what are you talking about? It's like, but you can't. You're not supposed to be able to do that, to take that many steps. I don't think it makes the game more fun. I think the game is more fun when the rules are held to. Like you said, they're skilled players. Make them be skilled. Make them play. That's the excitement, that they can play that well within the same rules. If you see these guys and there's no rules to it, then it becomes not fun to watch. And I don't know what kind of money the NBA is making. Probably a great amount because of the TV contracts. I know they just renegotiate and they're making a ton of money. But I don't know. I've watched some highlights this year and the stands don't look full to me like they used to. So I don't know if people are getting turned off by it. But as a fan, I don't care for it when it gets just no rules and let a guy do whatever he wants. So I think in the end it'll hurt their product.
Yeah, I think it always does. And that's why in other sports, too, I'm glad that there have been more rules enforced, especially in hockey and football, hits to the head, and those sort of things. And just help making kids even be safer, learn the better techniques when they're younger, with that sort of thing, with contact. But and translating this to what we're talking about, like you said, if the pros at the highest levels have to obey certain rules, it helps make everything safer if it's a rule about safety, and it makes the game better because they set the standard. They set the example, I guess.
Well, one of the reasons I think games are getting more dangerous, like if you want to talk about football, it's just the size of the players. They were talking about that during a game last night because the Redskins were playing, and if you're familiar with them from the 80s, their offensive line, they were called the Hogs. They were big guys, right? So they showed them like a graphic of them and how much those guys weighed, and it was all like 245, 250. And then they showed the offensive line today, and it's all 320, 330, 340. Guys are too big. You can't play at that size and not get hurt. And so they're trying to take away the injuries, but if you're launching yourself, because what are you going to do? If you're a running back and you weigh 250, 60 pounds, or a tight end probably, and you got a cornerback coming up trying to tackle him at 180, 200. What are you going to do? Launch yourself like a missile with your head.
Yeah.
So it's the size is just probably a little too big, I think. I don't know why people are getting so big. They're just eating more Big Macs, maybe? I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I think we've had a lot of advancements in, what they call it, sports nutrition, quote unquote, which is protein supplements, that kind of thing, to make people better and stronger. When it's just powders and things aren't natural.
Well, they're getting, but it's more injuries. They're more injury prone, I think. So even though they're bigger, they get hurt more.
Yeah, because you, the thing is too, you can get big, but can you get to a point where your body can't sustain your own size, or it's not really you because you're putting all these extra things in your body to sustain yourself. So I think people are getting hurt because they're getting so big or strong that their body can't actually physically support the what they're building. And so I think if they backed off a little bit and found the natural balance, they would be able to have a healthier, more stronger body frame because of that.
But they make the game funner. Yeah. More fun. Trumpet Daily Radio Show and the Key of David program coming up here in a bit on KPCG as well. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Lots of different topics today. One is Angela Merkel. She's going to run for a fourth term in Germany over there as the for the top office in the land. And also talked about President Obama is saying that he may speak out against Donald Trump if he doesn't like what he's doing. Usually former presidents remain silent, but he says he may not. I guess he probably won't. I'll take him at his word. So pretty interesting, a lot going on in Europe and America, and they impact each other. Really interesting write-up in relation to that from Der Spiegel. America has abdicated its leadership of the West. This is what's coming out of Germany, and a really interesting write-up. A couple of points about that. It says now, this author says, we now face emptiness, talking about Germany, and Europe, I guess, the fear of the void. What will happen to the West, to Europe, to Germany, without the United States as its leading power? Germany is a child of the West, particularly of the United States, brought to life with American generosity, long spoon-fed, and now in a deep state of shock, talking about this election with Donald Trump. The American president was always simultaneously our president, at least a little. And then he says that Barack Obama was a good president. That's an interesting thought there. He says, now, though, we must come to terms with a lack of Western leadership. And then he says, the leaders of the West, minus America, face monumental tasks ahead. They are tasks for German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She represents a strong country, and she has a strong moral foundation, as she demonstrated in the refugee crisis. She doesn't have to be a Woodrow Wilson, but she should become a decisive leader of Europe. If she doesn't, it will mean that she has not recognized the signs of the times. Pretty chilling comments from Germany if you know much about their history.
Yeah, this is really interesting perspective because he does bring out a lot of good points on how modern Germany is a product of America, especially with the Marshall Plan, all the billions of dollars that went into rebuilding Germany after World War II. And the fact that he ties Germany's self-interest to American self-interest too, I think that's interesting. But What's more so is that everyone's assuming, including Germany, that with the election of Donald Trump, America won't take the lead in the world. So who will? Who's going to fill that power vacuum? And Der Spiegel says, well, Merkel should. And that's a huge development because there's lots of other leaders who want to take on the want to take that mantle from the United States, Russia, China, in their different regions, Iran too. And so this is a golden opportunity for a lot of German politicians who have always wanted Germany to take a bigger role. There's no secret that some Germans want Germany to become a major power again.
Right.
Angela Merkel's not really one of them. I think she's more of a conservative, stick to the plan. I don't think she really wants Germany to be too expansionist. But there's a lot of Germans who do want Germany to become a major power, and this is their golden ticket.
Yeah, and she just may not be the person for the job, though.
Yeah.
And that's probably what we'll see happen. And there's a lot written at thetrumpet.com about that and what you can expect to see over there in Germany. Of course, you know, nobody knows exactly how it'll break down, but there's some pretty good indication from Bible prophecy. You can find more about that at thetrumpet.com and listen to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today as well. Speaking of the U.S. and the changing power, Abraham, you've got a story here from the American Interest. Lessons from History, Donald Trump's New World Order. What a Kissinger-inspired strategy might look like, his cabinet's taking shape, and there's some insight, some thinking here into what his worldview looks like.
Yeah, this is written by Neil Ferguson, so he's a respected historian and intellectual. And he basically, in this article, he breaks down one of the possible strategies Trump might take, but also which historical president mirrors the world situation, who he might want to emulate. And first, he just breaks down the situation Trump inherits from President Obama. And basically, it's interesting to think about what's going on in the world, and that Trump is inheriting a world in worse shape than the one Obama inherited from George W. Bush. And he goes through a lot of proof of that. And I think we can see it where China is on the rise in the East, far more aggressive than ever before. Russia has the Ukraine, Crimea, their power in the Middle East, the first time since the 1970s. You have Islam on the rise again. You have terrorism. You have ISIS. You have all these things really being resurgent under President Obama's leadership. And so Donald Trump really inherits a very difficult situation where he has to confront a rising European power, like with European interests coming to a head on where the EU wants to go, China and Russia, what do you do with Iran? So he has a lot of big decisions to make here. And so Neil Ferguson says that the president or the historical example Mr. Trump should follow should that be that of Theodore Roosevelt. Which I think is a great point, because Theodore Roosevelt was president when America was just coming into power, and there's some differences. But if he takes the course of power politics, where America has to use its power to broker deals to have a balance of power in the world against all these different rivals, then I think we can confront having a weaker economic system and try to have a strong military too. Because if you look at some of the things Theodore Roosevelt and Donald Trump have said, they're actually very similar, even especially on immigration, which is really interesting. But in terms of a world order, Neil Ferguson makes the point that Donald Trump will have to make a lot of tough decisions, and he should follow Theodore Roosevelt's example of speaking softly and having a big stick, but doing a better example than President Obama has of using the power when you need to.
Yeah, well, it is going to be a tough situation for the new administration. It is a dangerous world, isn't it? You just look at what Russia's done over the past few years. They're much more aggressive. China's more aggressive in certain ways. Europe, obviously, now openly, Germany especially, openly talking about leading the West. So, and then Iran. Of course, you can't forget about Iran over there and all that they're doing. And so things are really, really all in play. You know, all the pieces are kind of liquid in terms of, you know, you're not exactly sure where it's all leading, unless you look back to history. That gives you some idea. And then if you look at Bible prophecy as well. But otherwise, everything is sort of in play. And it's you can't totally rely on the same allies that nations have relied on in the past. I think people are looking. They're hoping they can rely on the U.S. Like, I think Israel would hope that the new administration would be more friendly towards them. But it is interesting to see. And they had, of course, one of the stories over the weekend was President Obama and Vladimir Putin having a little bit of a meeting there at some other meeting. They just talked to each other for a few minutes, and the death stare that they gave each other.
Right.
It was pretty intense. It's always hard to read into what exactly is going on there, but they don't seem like they like each other very much. But there again, you know, at least outwardly, Trump has praised Putin somewhat, which could be somewhat nerve-wracking, I guess. He's been a dictator over there in Russia.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the major themes the liberal media have taken, is that Trump's friendliness with Putin and Russia. But like you mentioned, the world's in a very liquid state where a lot of change is happening, where there's a lot of uncertainty of where these different policies are going to result in. But I think with the Trump presidency, what we're going to see is basically a reversion away from liberal thought. So liberal foreign policies really dominated America, even with Republicans in the presidency, with Woodrow Wilson making the League of Nations, and then United Nations later. Those are all ideas from liberalism, where we all can get together, we can sit down, talk about our problems, solve them without that there's an international body governing all the nations. That's a very liberal idea of politics. And the more realist one is that you have to use your power, your pure power, military power, economic power, to try to basically force other nations to do what you want. And then it all balances out in this system of equilibrium. And so Neil Ferguson says that that's probably the direction a lot of politics are going to be taking in this new era, and not just the United States, other nations too, where instead of relying on the talking table, on negotiations, a lot of nations are just going to start using their militaries to do the talking for them. And I think when you see the way the world's going, that's almost the way America's going to have to force to go, because a lot of these nations are talking with their military, and America's been silent. So if America does want to make an impact, they will have to talk. But as we know, with Bible prophecy and other things, that no president, no man can solve the problems that are facing America right now, and just the gulf of leadership, and the complexity of the problems, and just this all the different fronts going on in the world, they're just going to overwhelm any leader, any nation.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see like the way that the say the media, maybe even globally, I don't know, but that they kind of view things in contrast that to the way actual citizens and people on the ground in different countries view things. Because even that little bit from Der Spiegel where that guy was saying, the author was saying that, you know, Angela Merkel is, you know, she leads a strong nation that has this good moral compass and because of the refugee crisis. But the people in Germany aren't happy about the refugee crisis. Like, she's taken a hit.
Yeah.
But to him, you know, she's this great bastion of, the West. But really, on the ground there, at least from some of the headlines you see, people are not happy. There's unrest. And we saw that happen here in the U.S., and I think Europe's a little bit worried about that, the leaders over there, that they have a sense that what the people want, but the people really don't want that. If Donald Trump got into office, the media would have told you Hillary Clinton will win, 99% chance. People didn't want that, though. So the thinking of the media and the elite, I guess, versus what's happening on the ground, they seem to be two different things.
Yeah, that's actually another point Neil Ferguson brings out in his article, is that there's this huge gap, and it's become very evident, between the intellectual class, the working class, the normal people who don't necessarily have a say in decision making, besides voting. And so there's this huge gulf. We've seen that with Brexit, with Donald Trump's election, and I think in Europe, what we're seeing, and what that Der Spiegel author, I think, misses the point, is that in Europe, we're not seeing progression towards more liberal democracy. We're seeing a regression back to what Europe used to be.
Right.
Which is its more religious, staunch religious roots, conservatism, or less democracy and just more autocratic power. That's what we're seeing Europe move towards, and almost every other nation too. And to me, they don't have to fear a populist democratic type system. They have to fear reverting back to some forms of government that cause a lot of problems in this world.
All the nations seem to be becoming more authoritarian, don't they?
Yeah.
Obviously, Vladimir Putin, even Donald Trump, I guess you could say there's a potential there. You know, Europe's, the far right parties have been gaining in Europe in some of the elections. So it has people nervous. I think some of the elites, or as you would call them, you know, they're sitting there trying to look at this big worldview. But most people are thinking about their home view, their pocketbook, their protection, their safety. And I think that's where the breakdown in thinking occurs, the division occurs. Because, yeah, okay, whatever, they can worry about their own problems. I got to make sure I'm getting my money and I'm getting, you know, my food and what I need. And I think those are the separating point between the two ways of thinking.
Yeah, and we've seen, too, that the elites' policies aren't working. I mean, that's why people don't want them anymore. That's why we're seeing this pushback by the middle classes, is because there's more violence in the world. The economy is doing very poorly. There's just a lot more trouble. People aren't happy anymore. So their policies aren't working, and they just want to keep pushing them. But we're seeing this pushback because they're not working, and then we're going to see that the far right's policies don't work either. And that's, I think that's the grand lesson in all of this.
And they're still traveling in the NBA, too.
Right.
So it's all going the wrong direction. A lot more about some of these topics at thetrumpet.com. That'll do it for us today on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blundo, have a great rest of your Monday, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.